the week of October 7th, 2012, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 166, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
So, Michael, did you have a good weekend?
I did. The Yankees won. I'm a big baseball fan, and the Yankees won in Baltimore. So step one to, in the postseason, so I'm very happy. I saw a very good musical on Friday called The Old Man and the Old Moon by a talented group called Pigpen Theater. And on Sunday, I saw A Chorus Line, a revival in Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey, which was also solid. So a good weekend all around.
So you didn't go and see Jack White at Radio City Music Hall because, you know, he had a big show there over the weekend.
No, that was a week ago.
That was a week ago.
That was on the 1st. I love Jack White. I've never seen the White Stripes, who are now disbanded, or Jack White in concert. But he was playing at Radio City Music Hall, which is the worst venue imaginable for a rock and roll concert. You can see Tony Bennett there. You better be close. But Jack White at Radio City is just a bad mix. I'd never go see rock acts there.
Well, you know, the news was that he played for 45 minutes, songs from his new solo album, and then walked off stage. And that was the end of the show. And needless to say, fans were a little upset. But
really?
you know, you say that it's a Radio City Music Hall is a bad place to see a show. And I remember seeing a show there years and years and years ago. And the performer was Joe Jackson.
Oh, Joe Jackson, of course. Guy who is not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
A guy who's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. We'll definitely get to that in a second. Now, for those of you who don't know who Joe Jackson is, let me just play a little clip here. You might recognize this song. So this is Steppin' Out, okay? And I guess let me get to the chorus. Okay, so that's, you know, for those of you who...
It's a new age 70s rocker, still performing today, still recording. An act I really like, Body and Soul, is my favorite album by his. And I've always been afraid. I don't know, you haven't told me a thing, but I've always been afraid to see him in concert because I remember reading that he angrily told people to shut up, don't sing along. People are here to hear me sing, not you. So I remember that in Rolling Stone in the 80s. I thought, oh my God. And I actually eventually went to him with a good friend of mine and had a fun time. But he has a prickly... personality, that's for sure.
Well, actually, that was on that particular story where he was yelling at the audience was, I believe, in New York, in fact. I could be wrong about that part, but it was on an album called Big World, which he was recording live during the shows, and it worked out eventually, but people were singing along with him, and he was like, no, I'm recording. And I think it came out as that he was prickly and told people to stop singing. Joe Jackson is probably best known. And by the way, you say he's 70s new age. Most of his career was in the 80s and 90s. So,
And today,
yes. Now he's probably best known for a little song called,
What's Joe Jackson?
Okay, hold on. I'll get to the chorus here. Now, you must be wondering, Michael, what the hell happened?
Get going. Yeah, and his first two albums came out in 1979. Look Sharp, I'm the Man. What happened? Did you see him in concert?
So I'm going to go downtown and see Joe Jackson. It was at the point at like 6 o'clock on Saturday that I began to have an out-of-body experience. Drive downtown, 2 hours in traffic, eat at one of these hipster restaurants that, you know, everybody there is just too hip to even eat because they're just so darn hip. That this restaurant has, which I won't name, but, you know, their mixed drinks, their cocktails, each one has ice shaped differently for the drink. That's how, you know, hip they are.
You're seeing him at Radio City Music Hall?
No. This was years ago I saw him in Radio City Music Hall. This is this Saturday, my little Jackson out-of-body experience. I'm going to see Joe Jackson and his big band for their new album. I guess he has an album out where he reinterprets Duke Ellington hits. And I'm going to see him at a theater called the Orpheum Theater. The Orpheum Theater is a big movie palace, former movie palace, in the heart of downtown Los Angeles and in the heart of the movie theater district, or what was the movie theater district. And I'm eating dinner at this restaurant, and I guess the theater is across the street, the back of the theater is across the street. Who should come walking out of the gate there at the parking lot? Joe Jackson, just kind of like meandering down the street. Nobody pays him any attention. He walks down the street. 15 minutes later, he walks back. Meanwhile, I know I'm not missing the show because, well, the main act isn't there. He walks back. He's got Starbucks in his hand. Walks back in nonchalant. Nobody recognizes him. And then I go to this old movie palace, sit down, and I realize first of all, my presence there drops the average age by about 5 years because everybody's like in their 50s or 60s. And I realize that this is a guy who, this is one of his hit songs. Let me play you this song.
Oh, God.
You'll see where I'm going with this. Hold on. Let me.
True. If you want to know about the gay politician.
Yeah.
If you want to know how to drive your car. If you want to know about the new sex position. You can read it in the Sunday papers.
Okay, so he's singing about newspapers, right?
He's so old, he doesn't even know about the digital era, okay?
So, well, no, but that's what you'd think. He winds up the show playing, and I'm going to try and find... Oh, here it is. Okay, here, just bear with me. This is the...
What, are you playing his entire catalog? What is going on?
No. This is the song that he winds up closing with, and it's he closed a lot of his shows with this song. Okay, so he's singing this song, A Slow Song is the name of the track there, and he is turning the pages of his sheet music on an iPad. The guy is singing in an old movie theater, converted old movie palace, on a synthesizer, which he used to sing on a, and you play a grand piano, and he's singing about Sunday papers and DJs while reading the sheet music off of his iPad. And I just thought, this is really weird. Do you see my point here, or was this a long walk for a very short payoff?
It was a medium walk, at least. But I hope you get royalties for playing Joe Jackson music on the show.
Well, I don't know if I'll get any royalties for it.
Well,
but
we might be mentioning Joe Jackson later in the show, but what else will we be covering?
Well, speaking about long walks for short payoffs, I guess I probably shouldn't begin a show about entertainment news that way. But hey, on this week's episode, we are going to be talking to Stacey Spikes, the CEO of an unlimited film-going service. We told you about this service last year. It's called MoviePass. And after some initial struggles last year, MoviePass relaunched this past week with a retooled offering. And Mr. Spikes will be here to tell us why this time the offering won't upset movie theaters or the big studios. Now, you mentioned the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think, 5 or 10 times, Michael. And indeed, they have announced this year's nominees. And guess what? We, the public, get to vote on who makes the cut. Sort of. One group that may be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame someday is Mumford & Sons. They have a new album out, and it is just off the charts. Literally. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie around the world is the Liam Neeson action film Taken 2, which debuted to $105 million worldwide. I should say debuted in North America. It's made $105 million worldwide. It's at $117 million to date and counting. Here in North America, it was the number one film at the box office, a big success story for Liam. At number two around the world is Hotel Transylvania, the animated film starring the voice of Adam Sandler. It grossed $39 million worldwide. It's at $105 million to date. At number three is a film that's dropped off the U.S. charts. We wouldn't even be thinking about it, but it opened in some key territories, including Germany, and it's about to open in the U.K. So Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted, is the number one three film around the world. It grossed $23 million worldwide. It's at $668 million and counting.
Has anybody actually noticed the irony here that Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted, actually opened last in Europe?
Well, you know, save the best for last.
Okay.
And number four is Looper, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bruce Willis sci-fi action film, another $22 million that does not include figures from China. It opened in China, but those numbers are delayed, so it could be anywhere from a couple million to five or 10, or who knows how much. I don't know how wide it opened or what they did, but China figures are not available. So Looper is at least $22 million. It will probably be the number three film when all is said and done, and it's at $77 million and counting. And number five is an expansion of the Glee Goes to College musical Pitch Perfect, a new comedy. It's grossed $15 million worldwide. It's at $22 million and counting. And number six is Resident Evil Retribution, another $13 million. It just passed the $200 million mark. And number seven is Ted, another $12 million. The film directed by
Seth MacFarlane,
the host of the Academy Awards. It grossed $450 million so far. And number eight, Frankenweenie, the Tim Burton film. It opened in the U.S. a little softly at $11.5 million.
And by a little softly, we mean like a pillow. I mean, this thing was supposed to do $20, $30 million and did $11.5 million.
Yeah, I mean, it reportedly cost $39 million to make, which is awfully inexpensive, even for a stop-motion animated film. That's awfully inexpensive for a small movie, if that's what you can call an animated film like this. Tim Burton directed it. It's his idea, an expansion of a short. I'm suspicious of the $39 million budget figure, but if that's the case, then it's well on its way to profitability. At number nine is Ice Age Continental Drift, another $6 million. At number 10, the Jake Gyllenhaal drama End of Watch, which grossed $4 million. It's at $32 million worldwide and counting. And at number 11, the Clint Eastwood film Trouble with the Curve, which grossed another $3.8 million and obviously will not be a factor come Oscar time. One movie that might be is The Master, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix. That's still a limited release. It's doing about what we would expect for a movie of this type. It made another $1.8 million, and it's at $12 million and counting. You can bet it will have another burst of attention come the end of the year, awards and handouts and all that sort of stuff.
Well, okay, so Taken 2 tops the worldwide box office with $105 million, $50 million here at home, so it was a massive opening. So we're pretty much guaranteed we're going to see a Taken 3.
Well, I don't know. The first one, they kidnapped his daughter. The second one, they kidnapped his whole family. I guess they'll get down to like second cousins twice removed. I don't know. And how often can you be stupid enough to vacation in the country that is the home of the gangsters that you have thwarted in the first film?
Yeah, here's my hint to Liam Neeson's family in these Taken movies. Stop going to Europe, okay? Or better yet, stop going to Eastern Europe.
Oh, well, don't diss an entire continent or half a continent.
Yeah, well, no. I mean,
If you piss off people in Italy, don't go to Italy.
Right, exactly. If you piss off
people in Russia, don't go to Russia. It's nothing wrong with the continent. Just if you've got a little history, you might want to think twice.
Right, like if Liam Neeson happens to be your dad and, you know, maybe avoid the countries where he's pissed people off.
Now, the Universal film Pitch Perfect, I think, is a little interesting. It opened on about 300 screens last weekend, had a nice strong per screen average, and now this weekend expanded to 2,700 screens. And some people commented, specifically the people at Box Office Profit, they say, what a smart way to do this. They hate Wednesday openings because they think that just makes your weekend figure look smaller. And they don't like a single day sneak preview like on a Saturday night the week or two before. They say open it in limited release the weekend before, lets people sample it and see it. And then you get to expand properly. It's a great way to have word of mouth without doing some stuff that weakens your weekend box office. And they thought Pitch Perfect did a good job. However, I look at that number of 2,700 screens, and I think they went on to too many screens.
So they opened on 300, and then they jumped to 2,700. You're saying, hey, 2,700, too many screens.
Yes, because their per-screen average is about $5,000 per screen, which is respectable for a wide release. But, you know, Taken 2, for example, had a $13,000 per-screen average. What that means is that a lot of these screenings weren't full. If they'd opened on 1,200 screens or 1,400 screens, they would have probably made the same amount of money, or darn close to it. Because once you get over 1,200, 1,400 screens, all those extra screens, you're just getting tiny, tiny percentage of your total box office from that expansion.
Well, so remember, a lot of times the screens aren't necessarily there to have, you know, for capacity. They're there for the showtime as opposed to the capacity.
Right. But if you had fewer showtimes, you'd have more people at each show and people would have a better time. You could have made just the same amount of money, but had much fuller screenings. And a comedy, most movies benefit from a full audience. If you saw Pitch Perfect in a half-empty theater, you did not have as good an experience as the people who saw it if it was three quarters or almost all the way full.
And I'm sure exhibitors would say that, hey, you know, what's more convenient is having a showtime when you want to see it. So we'll put it on three screens. And that way, even though we won't fill all those three screens, if it's showing every half hour, that's more convenient to you, the customer, which is what you'd prefer. That's their thinking. I'm not saying that it's correct.
Wrong.
I'm saying, well, okay, you know.
No, what they want is people to have a happy, good time at the movies and keep coming back next week. If they make the same amount of money, sell the same number of tickets, they don't need 18 screenings of a movie per day. They can have 9.
Well, hey, wait a second. If they come back next week, if the customers come back to the theater next week, they should probably be a member of MoviePass.
That's right. We'll be getting to them soon enough. I feel like Hollywood is now in the habit of expanding movies way too broadly. They do have screenings every half hour sometimes. And what they sacrifice is a happy, good, positive movie-going experience. A small movie like Pitch Perfect was not going to need a ton of screenings per day. They didn't need to be on 2,700 screens. They didn't need that many screenings. They probably would have made just about the same amount of money, and I bet people would have had more fun at the movie.
Have you seen the movie?
I haven't, though I want to. It's by the guy who directed the Broadway production of Avenue Q, so I'm a fan, and I want to see what he's done.
Well, the reason I ask that is to see if there's any, you know, big breakout stars there that might go off and have either solo careers or join bands and have big careers. And maybe one day, just one day, they might, if they're really, really good enough, they can be a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
I doubt it. Okay. If they're lucky, they'll get a sitcom on the CW.
Okay. Well, actually, for the first time in its history, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will offer fans the opportunity to officially participate in the induction selection process. And this is going to begin, I guess it began last Thursday, October 4th, and it's going to continue through December 3rd. The public is going to be able to vote for the 5 nominees they believe to be the most deserving of induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The top 5 artists, as selected by us, basically, by Michael and I and all of you out there, they will comprise a quote-unquote fans ballot that will be tallied along with the other ballots to choose the 2013 inductees. In other words, it will count as one ballot.
Well, let's say like you're a member of Motley Crue. Maybe they get to vote. I don't know. I doubt it. But say they do. There's 4 members of Motley Crue. They get to vote. They each get a ballot. If you were the 5th member of Motley Crue, you'd get to fill out a ballot too. It's fun. You know, it's nice to be able to vote for the Oscars, but obviously one ballot isn't going to influence people. But it won't change the tallies. I assume there are very few ties. But they can all see who we're voting for. And we can influence them by strongly supporting one or two acts that they might not have necessarily included. So you can see on the shortlist this year is the band Rush, which has a fanatical fan base. And they are way, way ahead in the polling from fans. You can go online. If you vote, you can then see who's in what place. Rush has a huge lead. And so the people in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame go, yeah, you know what? Maybe they'll start to think, yeah, you know what? They'll sense all that fan love and they'll think, yeah, you know, Rush, now that I think about it, this, that, and the other thing, you know, I think they do deserve to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So you can have an effect. You can influence the way the other people vote.
Well, okay, so let's talk about some of the other folks who are nominated here. We've got Randy Newman, Joan Jett and the Blackhearts, Kraftwerk, the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, which is, you know, of course, everybody knows them, Heart, Deep Purple, and I don't know if I mentioned the Meters, Public Enemy was nominated, as which I can't imagine that they would consider themselves rock and roll.
Hell yes.
Nor would NWA, but
hell yes. They're the rock and roll of today, baby.
Okay, well, Donna Summer is also nominated.
And Chic.
Yes,
and Chic. The blues man Albert King and the girl group The Marvelettes. That's the complete list of the short list of people who are eligible to be voted in. It doesn't have to be just 5, I don't think. I'm not sure what number of final nominees they will accept. Maybe it is just 5 a year. I don't know. But in the general category of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, this is the shortlist from which they will pull the winners, the people who get announced and inducted into the Hall of Fame. And according to everyone I've spoken to, in my opinion, this is a really poor list.
Yeah, I would
agree.
There's
a lot of
you.
People here who shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, who don't deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, who shouldn't even be considered for the Hall of Fame. And when you think about all the acts that are not in yet and are already eligible, it's just a bizarre list. And I can imagine I'll end up with 5 that will be very respectable and look great and look just as impressive as the list from years past. But there are so many acts they're ignoring that you just scratch your head. My top 5 picks would be Randy Newman, who's one of my favorite acts of all time. He also, I think, brought a lot of strains, a lot of music back into rock and roll that was missing. A lot of people draw on blues and gospel and folk. Randy Newman draws on Stephen Foster and Dixieland and a whole strain of Americana that people were not thinking about in the 70s as being appropriate or, you know, a part of the rock and roll palette that they could draw from. Beyond being a great songwriter and having three or four absolutely brilliant albums, I think he's really important as far as the music he kept alive and kept in the musical vocabulary. Kraftwerk, obviously, is an extremely influential band. They spawned an entire genre of electronica. Donna Summer is...
And we should point out, not the owner of Macaroni and Cheese.
Not at all. Yeah. Donna Summer's a mainstay of disco, and she's won Grammys for her rock vocals, her pop vocals, R&B, and gospel. She was nominated for pop vocals as well, but she's been acknowledged in a lot of different genres. Public Enemy, obviously, I think they get the edge over NWA. Both are probably worthy, but Public Enemy is first. And Rush, I have to include, because my friend Brian would beat me up if I didn't.
Well, and Donna Summer would be honored posthumously. She passed away earlier this year.
That's true. That might give her a fan. But Paul Butterfield Blues Band, no. Heart, no. The Marvelettes, they're like a third-tier girl group. And I wouldn't even include Procol Harum, though they have one or two very good albums. And
Oh, Procol Harum is nominated. Okay, yeah.
That's right. We forgot to mention them. So there's a string of, and when you think about all the bands that aren't on the list, we have a long list for you, but the Smiths are not on the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Roxy Music, Todd Runyon, New Order, Linda Ronstadt, Kiss, Iggy Pop, The New York Dolls, The Replacements, B-52s, Big Star, Stevie Ray Vaughan, The Pixies, The Jam, Depeche Mode, Captain Beefheart, Sonic Youth, Brian Eno, Carole King, Husker Du, Dire Straits, Hall & Oates, Eric B. and Rakim, Black Flag, The Commodores, Meatloaf, The Specials. There's a lot of people you can consider for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. This shortlist should make you scratch your head and go, oh my God, who am I going to choose? Not look at it and go, wow, there's a lot of bad choices on here.
That's true. I mean, you'd think that The Cure would already be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, The Cure, Television, Eurythmics, Joe Cocker, Peter Tosh, The Pogues.
I got you started again.
Airport Convention, The English Beat, Sinead O'Connor, Steve Winwood, Dionne Warwick. My favorite act of all time, practically. Richard Linda Thompson is not on the list. Richard Thompson is one of the great guitarists of all time on both acoustic and electric guitar. He's part of the Fairport Convention, which is the British equivalent of the band. He has a duo with his then-wife Linda, and then as a solo act for 30 years, going on 40 years. He's been one of the greatest rock and roll artists of all time, wildly acclaimed throughout the years, a long and distinguished career. It's embarrassing that he's not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Is Joe Jackson in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
No, he is not. And he's, you know, he's one of the many people you can argue about. Does he have a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame career? You know, you've got to draw the line somewhere. He's certainly someone to give serious consideration, certainly ahead of the Marvelettes.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, we started off the show by talking about this concert and kind of in a humorous way and my little
hopefully.
Hopefully humorous, although it did come from me. So let's face it, probably wasn't that funny. But, you know, I was thinking while I was sitting there in my looking down on myself since it was an out-of-body experience. And there I was, there Joe was. And I thought to myself, hey, you know what? This guy could never get signed today. No record company would touch this guy with a 10-foot pole.
Why do you say that? Because he's balding?
No, just because, you know, here's a guy who's singing. It's just, I don't know. I just can't imagine... Hey. Somebody, you know, I don't know. I just can't imagine.
Today, he doesn't need to be signed by a record label. He's a great songwriter. He would go on YouTube. He'd post his songs. He'd release his album via iTunes. He'd build his fan base with touring. He's an excellent live act, and he wouldn't need a record label. He wouldn't want to sign with them, and he would follow his quixotic path, going into jazz and a little bit of classical and, this Duke Ellington cover album and all the other things he's done over the years, and he'd follow that path and be happy as a clam, and I think have equivalent success.
Yeah, singing songs about the Telegraph.
That's right.
Well, you know, another band that you would think never in a million years would this band be popular. I mean, let's face it, they have a banjo player as one of their like lead instrumentalists. I can't pronounce that word.
Instruments.
Thank you very much.
But why? Of course they would be popular. What are you talking about?
They have basically turned bluegrass into a
they're not a bluegrass band. Hey, Mumford & Sons is
folk?
Not a bluegrass band. They have a banjo, but they are not a bluegrass. They
what
don't have a hint
them?
Of bluegrass. They're Americana or rock and roll, whatever you want to call it, but they're not bluegrass.
Okay, well, they're something, and
they're a rock band.
You know what they are? They're incredibly successful. You know why? Because they just sold, in their first week, their new album sold 600,000 units. Now, I know, Michael, what you're going to say. That's nothing. Back in the 80s, we used to sell...
No, that's a good number even for the old days.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Absolutely. No, 600,000 is serious money.
And that's actually the most, I guess, what, the highest sales figure for the year, right? 600,000?
Yep. Almost doubling the sales of Justin Bieber's new album.
Which is... okay.
Justin Bieber's a big act.
I know he is, so I shouldn't be. So that includes 180,000 CDs, 420,000 digital downloads of the album, biggest debut of the year, as we mentioned. Justin Bieber, for those of you who are wondering how many albums he sold in his first week, 374,000 albums.
Right, and it's also the biggest sales week for a rock album in 4 years.
Really?
Yes, back in 2008, AC/DC sold 784,000 copies of their new album. It's the biggest, second biggest sales week digitally in history, behind only Lady Gaga, but she did it thanks to Amazon having a 99-cent sale. So
that's
true. Has a little asterisk by it. I mean, they sold them, but this was full price, so that's pretty darn impressive.
You know what I think is really probably the most impressive, and maybe even more telling and more important, is that this was an album that was streamed 8 million times on Spotify before it was released.
Before?
Well, the week it was released. Let's say that.
It came out. It was available for listening on Spotify.
That's
the same week it came out.
That's right. And everybody used to think, oh my goodness, you know, if you release your music on Spotify, it's eating into your sales. So groups like the Black Keys, they pull their music from Spotify. I think the Black Keys pulled all their music. And Coldplay said, well, you can have the music, but only a week or two after it's been released so that people have to go buy it and then you can have it. And you know what? What Mumford & Sons is proving here is, hey, get people used to your music and have a great touring act. And guess what? It doesn't matter whether you're on Spotify. In fact, Spotify is helping you market your music.
Well, that's possible. It could also still be hurting sales.
Well,
there's no
possible
reason to think that if it wasn't available for free listening on Spotify, that they might not have sold 800,000 or a million copies. And they certainly, if they had increased their sales by even 50,000 copies, they probably would have received a lot more money than they did from Spotify for that streaming of 8 million times.
Okay, so what you're saying is they may have lost money.
It may be good promotion or it may be lost sales. I'm tending to think it's lost sales. I don't think that's necessarily you don't want to be on Spotify, but I don't think you can blithely say, well, see, it helped. It didn't hurt album sales. Well, I bet it did. Why not? If you can listen to it for free, why would you buy it? I don't belong to Spotify, so I have to buy it.
Well, I do belong to Spotify, and I will tell you that I am going to
own Babbel?
Not yet. This is a huge but. I'm actually going to purchase it. Now, why am I going to purchase it? Because I listened to the full album on Spotify last week after reading this story. I went, oh, they do have a new album out. That's right. Let me listen to it. I listened to it. Mumford & Sons happens to be a band that I like, okay? I enjoy them. They are a band that I would normally go out and purchase the album. Same thing with like a U2 or a Bruce Springsteen. So what am I going to do? I'm going to go out and buy the album. Yes, I have a subscription to Spotify, and I could listen to it there or on RDO or on any of these streaming services. But the reality is, if I am not a paying member that month or in a future month, I'm not going to be able to listen to it. This is a band I want to support through sales.
Right. And of course, you want to listen to it in your car or you want to listen to it on your iPhone whenever you want. You know, it's not necessarily, you don't always have access to Spotify
Spotify, you can download the music. If you're a paid subscriber and a premium subscriber, you can download the music for offline listening.
For how long?
Well, until the end of the month. And, you know, if you don't pay for your subscription.
No, I'm saying is if you download it and you keep your monthly subscription, you can listen to it forever?
Yes.
Oh, wow. How many albums can you download in a month?
As many as you'd like. But, of course, you don't pay that subscription at the end of the month and they'd all disappear. That's correct.
Okay.
As many albums as your iPhone can handle is the number of albums you can download.
All right. What format is it released in, MP3?
It is not. It's, you know, some proprietary format that's not MP3. It's like in their app. Yeah, it's in their app. You're not listening to it through, you know, iTunes or the music. Yeah, it's.
But you don't have to be online.
You don't have to be online, no.
Okay, good to know.
Okay, so I'm glad I could fill you in on how Spotify works, at least if you're a premium subscriber. I'm hoping that you can fill me in on what the heck is going on Broadway with this production of Rebecca. Now, I'm assuming this is the Rebecca that Alfred Hitchcock made a film of.
That's correct.
Okay. So, of course, since all Broadway shows now have to be films first, I think it's a new law.
Well, it was a novel.
Okay, fine.
It's a classic gothic novel, gothic romance.
All of a sudden, I'm reading the New York Times, and there's all this news about Rebecca, the production, and it's in trouble, and the producer can't raise the money, and he was raising the money from some some investor who was or was not an actual person, and then there's some
fraud. Well, it's an exciting story. It's obviously more interesting than the musical itself, which is not appearing. It's collapsed. I don't want to say the name of the author because I don't know how to pronounce it. It's Daphne du Maurier. I don't know how to say it.
Very, very good. That's exactly how you pronounce it.
Really? Well, there you go.
In my own mind, it is. I don't
know. So it's a European musical. It began in Germany. It ran for 3 years in that country, which is an extremely long time. That's a big hit. And it's had productions in other parts of Europe. Now, this Broadway figure, Ben Sprecher, was trying to make the leap from behind the scenes to a lead producer on a Broadway show. It's a big leap. And he wanted to make it with Rebecca. He brought in a lot of talent. Michael Blakemore, the director, choreographer Francesca Zambello, and the book writer Christopher Hampton, who adapted Les Liaisons Dangereuses. So it's a
wait
big...
a second. You were going to have a hard time pronouncing du Maurier, and then you try to pronounce whatever it was you just tried to pronounce?
Les Liaisons Dangereuses. Dangerous liaisons.
Okay, fine. All right.
I think I did it right.
Yeah, you
but
did.
But anyway, high-powered cast, high-powered team of creative talent behind the show. They budgeted at $12 million. They scheduled it for January of 2012. Financing fell through. It got delayed. Then they scheduled it for November of 2012. All right, here we go. I've seen ads. They've got a TV ad. They've got the posters. They've got the Broadway house booked. They've got the cast. Everything's going along fine. Suddenly, the producer, Ben Sprecher, says, I'm in trouble. Oh, my God, I'm in trouble.
And he's not being mugged on the subway. He's like in financial trouble. His show is in trouble.
That's right, because one of the producers on the show suddenly died. This South African fellow based in Europe died, and he was responsible for $4.5 million of the show's $12 million budget, so more than a third. And obviously, they didn't have the money yet. So it suddenly, you know, they didn't know what was going on. Everybody's like, what? Who's this guy? What happened? And they look it up and they're like, there's no notice of his death. They can't find any description of him in Africa, South Africa, or in England, in the UK, where he's supposed to be based. There's no notice anywhere. Who is this guy? Turns out he doesn't exist. So it's then the producer has to say, well, now that you mention it, I never actually met him. And
right.
It didn't seem strange at the time. But when his deal fell through in the early 2012, you know, everybody heard about it, that he needed more money. This guy comes forward named, what is his name?
Mark Hotten. Mark C. Hotten of West Islip.
This guy with apparently a history of fraud comes forward and says, I can hook you up with a guy with a lot of money. It's a South African guy. He's got tons of it. There used to be a tradition in Hollywood where middlemen who brought people in to invest in a Broadway show would get a cut of the money. So if I brought you an investor who was going to give you $100,000, you would pay me, you know, $10,000 or $5,000 or whatever the figure might be that you agreed on.
Yeah, it's like a finder's fee. It's very normal.
It was normal in Broadway. It's pretty much faded. You know, it doesn't happen much anymore, but it did happen in the past. It's not unheard of. So this guy was in that sort of deal. But now this doesn't make any sense to anyone. What's the point of bringing in a fake investor? You're not going to get the money. So, like, nobody can understand what's going on here.
You're not
going
to get the fake money that you promised.
Right.
Yeah.
He doesn't get any money till they get the money, obviously. Yeah, right. And the investor doesn't exist. So then this fell through. He reached out to other people. A couple other people stepped forward. None of them are real either. And they don't seem to be connected to this guy. He's had like four fake investors offering up six or seven figures to invest in his show. So the show's fallen apart. Actors are out of work. And everybody's frankly going, what a great story. I'll bet this is better than the musical.
I bet you it is better than the musical. So I guess what you're saying is it's much harder to put on a Broadway show than Smash makes it look on television.
Smash doesn't make it look easy.
Well, yeah, they don't make it look this convoluted either.
Right. It's a very it does feel like a blast from the past, I have to say.
Well, and that's exactly what Scott Brown over at Vulture said. I guess Vulture being the New York Magazine blog. He says, and this is a quote, the stereotype of the sharp-lapelled Broadway BS artist endures. And the crime, if crime it be, to dream and dream badly, is pure, more beautiful than ever. Because at these prices, there's no room for the cynical charlatan. Only a dreamer can get this far and fail this badly. Rebecca may prove that maybe the Max Bialy stocks haven't been priced out by a post-producer's post-Disney Broadway after all. And he's referring to Max Bialystock of the producers. So,
he's sort of confused because he's talking about Mark Sprecher, I believe. Ben Sprecher.
Yes.
But he's not the Max Bialystock here. He gets duped by the Max Bialystock.
That's right. Yes.
But it's just a crazy old fashioned, you know, Broadway nutty thing. It only happens in Broadway. If you're making a movie, well, that does happen in movies.
I was going to say the same thing applies.
It's just a crazy, crazy story. So, no Rebecca. sorry, we won't be able to sing a song about Rebecca. No Broadway, you know, one musical has dropped out of the Broadway season, but we do have a story to remember.
That's true. And we do have an email from Rebecca later on in the episode.
Really?
Yes. But, and so let me ask you this. This whole thing, as far as Broadway goes, are people on Broadway, do they think this is like a big story, really important, or do they could care less?
It's definitely a big deal because it's affected a lot of people who turned down other work at a very serious, talented cast and creative crew involved. It's a guy that's had a long history on Broadway. People like him. Everybody seems to be very understanding. Like, oh, we feel terrible for Mr. Sprecher. It's a shame that this happened. Call my lawyer.
I'm suing you. Well,
absolutely. They're all, everybody's suing. Everyone's suing everyone.
Well, let's see if we can find a few more news stories that are big deals this week, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story is about Glastonbury, one of the premier summer music festivals in Europe. It sold out all of its tickets for the 2013 festival in a record 1 hour and 40 minutes, and that is a lot of tickets. The 205-pound vouchers. Now, they didn't weigh 205 pounds. That's actually a monetary amount in the UK, 205 pounds. They disappeared quicker. These vouchers, they just were gobbled up quicker than ever, thanks to a new, more muscular website that could handle the traffic of millions and millions of people trying their luck. Glastonbury, of course, is an annual event, though every once in a while it skips a year to catch its breath and to let the grass on that field grow, which was the case in 2012. So now they have a full house. Now all the organizers need to do, and this is very important, they need to book some acts, because there's no, the lineup hasn't been announced yet. That's right, not a single musical act has been announced. So fans bought tickets simply on the faith that Glastonbury would book the acts they want to see. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big whoop. It's an established festival. We see this. I think Coachella does this too, don't they, Sperling? Didn't you buy a ticket to Coachella sight unseen?
Yes, I did, darn it.
Yeah, so really, I mean, this is how it works. You want to book a year in advance. You're not going to have your acts announced. So fans really place their faith in the venue and the people organizing it rather than saying, oh, I want to see U2 or Springsteen or Mumford & Sons. They're trusting you to set up a string of acts that you're going to be excited about. If it doesn't work, obviously you won't come back.
One of the biggest indie success stories of the year so far is the Sundance winner Beasts of the Southern Wild, and we've talked about that in the past. It won the audience prize up at Sundance and has gone on to gross more than $10 million at the box office. It's hoping end-of-the-year awards will keep the film in the news, and that has certainly worked for the SAG Awards, just not the way the film intended. Beasts used local non-professional actors and failed to qualify for SAG's low-budget feature agreement, so it has been ruled ineligible for the SAG Awards. Hence, no recognition for the group of actors. Some have speculated that making news for being ruled ineligible is almost as good as being nominated, and that Beasts of the Southern Wild is sure to be in the mix for Critics Awards and for Oscars and the like come December. Go hush puppy. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. SAG is not that big a deal yet. It's not like being ineligible for a Golden Globe, which might give you a little more prominence. And if they're lucky, the little bit of news that they got for not being eligible for a SAG award could, you know, the fact that they got in the Hollywood Reporter and Variety, that certainly helps, keeps them in the minds of Hollywood.
And do you think anybody understood the Hush Puppy reference?
Well, everyone who saw Beasts of the Southern Wild, that's the name of the lead character, played by 8-year-old actress, God help me, this is a lot harder than Liaison Dangereux. It's Kuvenzeni Wallace.
I wouldn't
God,
even...
God, I forget. Forgive me, young woman, whoever you are. She's 9 years old now. Forgive me for butchering your name.
The FCC allowed some obscure regulation called the Sunset Program Access Rules to expire. Well, you know, whatever. Hey, how come I can't find my local baseball team on my cable provider anymore, Michael? And what the heck? I can't... Where are the Lakers? Yes, smaller cable and satellite companies fought to keep the rules in place. Rules that forced cable companies to make their programming channels available to rival providers. The rules were intended to foster competition and break the monopoly that cable companies invariably had in the early days. Since few people would purchase pay TV that didn't include local sports programming, for example, this was one way to ensure competitors weren't forever locked out of the market. It's worked so well that a DC Court of Appeals decided the rules were really no longer necessary to foster competition, because the competition is now present thanks to Dish, DirecTV, Verizon, and AT&T. So, the FCC let the rules expire, but still threatened to do case-by-case reviews of questionable actions. So, Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Very big deal, I think. It's bizarre. They're like, well, the rules worked. Let's get rid of them.
Right, exactly. I could not agree more. It's like, well, you know, these regulations seem to be perfect for this industry, so let's get rid of the regulations. Well,
right, so
no.
Who's going to keep the Dish Network if you can't suddenly get your PBS channel or your local sports franchise team or some other key channels that are really important to you? Nobody. People are going to dump them, and suddenly they won't be competitive anymore. Then they'll say, hey, let's bring those rules back.
Well, right. So the must-carries are, yeah, I completely agree. Here in Los Angeles, the Lakers are only on Time Warner. And they
get them on Dish or DirecTV?
No, because they're going to be played, most of their games, that is, will be played on the Time Warner Sports Channel, which is not available on Dish or DirecTV because those two providers have decided that they don't want to pay the $3.94 per month per subscriber to obtain the channel.
And that would be a case that would definitely go before the FCC, even while this rule was in place, and they would argue and fight over whether that was allowed.
Right, and the reason they don't want to pay it, long story short, is because if they pay $3.94 when it's just the Lakers, what happens when the Dodgers show up?
Right. Well, and $4, that's more than ESPN gets. That's a lot of money.
Exactly. So basically, you know, let's put it this way. In their training facility, guess what provider is used at the Lakers gym?
Not Time Warner?
DirecTV. So they can't even watch themselves.
That's funny.
Now, speaking of watching things, Netflix is launching the premiere of the David Fincher 13-part series House of Cards starting on February 1st in 2013. Wait, actually, hold on a second. Scratch that. Make that starting and ending on February 1st. That's because Netflix is looking at how people consume TV shows on their website and on, you know, through their DVD by mail service, and it has decided that people want it all. So they're giving them every single episode, all 13 episodes, posted and ready to view in a single day. Now, House of Cards stars Kevin Spacey. The miniseries is based on an acclaimed UK series. Season 2 of the show, which also stars Robin Wright, starts filming in the spring, presumably on more than one day. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I made you laugh. I think this is a big deal. It's a smart, smart way. This is how people want to watch TV shows now, and if they can do it, they will do it. Since they don't depend on advertising, there's no reason not to just put them all out there. I think it's kind of fascinating. Be interested to see how it works. People will do a marathon, gorge themselves in one or two days. Other people will spread it out. Will they make it available to critics in advance, I imagine? So it's just, it'll be fun to see how this works. I think it's smart, and I think it's right.
Yeah, and maybe if people don't invest like 12, 13 weeks of their life into watching your show, they won't be so mad when you kill off one of the lead romantic characters. And I'm talking about you, Hell on Wheels. Anyway, the book industry believes that critical fave Lena Dunham of HBO's Girls is wearing bossy pants. Get it? Because she's like the new Tina Fey, so...
Uh-huh, I got it,
okay,
I got it.
Okay, just checking. You know, because, you know, my jokes are always right, you know, right on target. I just... Anyway, publishers were in a lather, outbidding each other to snag the rights to a book of essays by Dunham detailing events like, you know, her first sexual experience, her fascination with death, and dating an older, famous movie director. Dunham shot to critical attention with her indie film Tiny Furniture and is now the creator and star of HBO's sitcom Girls. To book editors, that means she's the next Tina Fey, whose book of essays sold more than 1 million copies in hardcover and then even more in paperback. So the asking price is, you know, a cool $3.7 million, and Random House, this morning was announced, is the winner. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
What's a big whoop? She gets money to write a book. Good for her. But I think it's a bad bet. They're wagering that she's going to be a blockbuster hit. And that's just not smart. If you're making a movie, your business plan cannot include having to sell as many tickets as Avatar. And that's what they're doing here. $3.7 million means this has to be a massive success for them to make their money back. And I just don't get it. I mean, Tina Fey was on Saturday Night Live for like, what, 9 years, 10 years? She was on the hit films like Mean Girls. She was on 30 Rock and won Emmys for Best Actress and Best Show. I mean, she was you know, internationally known for making fun of Sarah Palin. I mean, she's a big, big figure in comedy for decades before she had this sort of success. Lena Dunham's show on HBO reaches like 1 million viewers a week.
Right. And I guess they're hoping that if every single one of those viewers goes out and buys this book, they'll make their money back. But if they don't, then they'll be in the red.
Right. So, yeah, it's not a good bet. It doesn't mean that it won't work. It doesn't mean it won't be a funny book or a good book. She's got talent. But to me, it's just not a smart deal.
Well, our next story is, well, I guess it's the definition of a big whoop because it's about the Jersey Shore. In fact, it looks like MTV packed up its bags and left the Jersey Shore just in time. The network announced the sixth season of the show would be its last, and now we know why. The new episodes dropped 40% in the ratings from last season and well down from the series high. Mind you, 4.7 million viewers makes Jersey Shore still the number one show on the cable channel, and its demos beat everything on cable but the NFL. So is MTV leaving money on the table or leaving well enough alone? Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big deal. It shows MTV made the right move, as you suggest. And the fact that it's still the number one show just means it was an out-of-size hit. And they're right. They got to get away before it taints their brand. They don't always want to be cool and forward-looking. And Jersey Shore, clearly, is past its sell-by date. They knew that. They're finishing it up now. It may be their number one show, but they got to cut their losses because the damage of a show that people think is a joke, or at least aren't laughing with anymore but are laughing at, is a lot worse than squeezing out a couple extra bucks by stretching out a series beyond the time when it was over. So they know it's not cool, it's not hot, and they got to walk away from it quickly.
And thus the reason we don't see Kate Plus 8 anymore.
That's not on the air anymore?
I don't know. Somebody's probably going to write in and tell me that it is on the air.
I bet it is.
I never watched it, so I don't know.
But again, I don't think Lifetime or whatever the Learning Channel, whatever channel K plus 8 was on, has the same need to be on top of trends. MTV does. They can't afford to be uncool. You know, teenagers are fickle. They move quick. And so I think that, you know, they're really smart in knowing that, you know, they can't linger. And when something's done, it's done. As recently as last year, K plus 8 was still on. They had K plus 8 the college years.
Ugh.
So Kate Gosselin and her kids are not done.
Ugh. Just my luck. Well, our lips are sealed, but Gwyneth Paltrow's, they're not. She wants you to know that she's working to develop a stage musical based on the storied career of the Go-Go's, one of the most successful female bands in rock history, probably not members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, along with Joe Jackson. They were legendary for partying, you know, just as hard as any other band, including footage of the gals toying with male groupies getting online in the early days of the internet. Lead singer Belinda Carlisle battled weight issues, drug use was prominent, and they found success even harder to deal with than their early struggles when a smash debut album was never quite matched by later releases. The band is talking and might even write some new songs for the project, which is in the very early stages of development. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. A Broadway show is possibly in the works. She hasn't even secured the rights yet, but it makes sense. It's fun. The problem is they don't have a really great arc to their story. They do have a reunion concerts, and they did battle, you know, illness and I think cancer and heart illness and other things and weight issues and drug addiction. They've got a great storied history. Great. Listen to me. They've got a, you know, a dramatic story. They certainly had a lot of fun on the road in their early days. They were, you know, competing with Van Halen for raunchy backstage antics. They really were. And so it's fun, but they had that big early success. And it was kind of all downhill from there. So how you craft that into a, maybe you just start with their early days and peak with their first album, because the rest of it, while it's a bit of a soap opera, just doesn't have quite the same dramatic arc. So maybe that's what they'll do. They'll look at the songs, mix them in, and start them from a nobody that people made fun of to really, they were kind of an instant success even in LA in the punk scene and had massive fan following and then exploded onto the world stage with their debut. They never matched that success again, commercially or creatively, but they had a lot of good singles after that. But that was by far their peak. So maybe their story will lead them up to that and they'll stop there. You miss out on some of the drama of their later careers and their tearful reunions. But, you know, if you want to make a show out of We Got the Beat and Vacation and, you know, Head Over Heels, maybe that's what you do.
And maybe they can do a crossover show with Mamma Mia.
See, Mamma Mia?
I'm just saying, you know, all the music, you know, never mind.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the Bangles.
Oh, yeah. Hey, they could. They could walk like an Egyptian. See, because
exactly.
The song.
I got it.
I don't know what's wrong with my humor today. Anyway, if you feel like we've already covered the breakthrough of ABC's Good Morning America over NBC's Today, well, you're actually right. But since Today stayed on top for literally decades, it's important to keep an eye out and see whether GMA maintains its newfound success and builds on it. They have, and they are. Good Morning America is suddenly the number one morning news show in the key 25 to 54 demographic and total viewers by significant margins. It won the premiere week kicking off the fall season, September 24th, and won the month of September as a whole. It hasn't won premiere week since 1992, exactly 20 years ago. Jim, first of all, how many TV shows last 20 years? Secondly, how many last 20 years when they're not the number one show in 20 years? GMA reached 4.9 million viewers versus today's 4.1 million viewers and CBS's early show, which also grew in numbers to 2.5 million. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? We all kind of know it's a big deal, right, Michael?
It is a big deal. This has been, I can remember 93 telling Eddie, please, GMA is not even close yet to beating NBC. Stop trying to pretend it's a horse race. And it wasn't. It took another 18 years for this to become a horse race. Now they're in the lead. It's astonishing to see after literally 20 years of seeing Today in front every single week. It's not a fluke. It's not a trend. It's an established fact. Now, the kind of astonishing thing here is that they've done it with their co-host, Robin Roberts, out. She's had bone marrow transplant. God bless her. She's in the hospital and recovering now. But she's been out ill. So it's been George Stephanopoulos and a string of guest hosts. You know, Robin Roberts had a tearful goodbye, I think, in early September. They're staying up to date with her and her progress, of course, all the time. They want her back as soon as possible. But that's been a big story for them. And it's just a family. That's what happens on these shows. They become a family. You get involved in their lives and what's going on. You remember that with Katie Couric on the Today Show. And it's happening on GMA. But this win in September and premiere week, it's just, this is it. There's been a change in the guard. It's going to take a long time and a change of hosts. Probably at GMA for Today's show to get a foot back in the door. It's kind of amazing. It's, you know, been 20 years in the making, and it's really happening. You know, you keep going, are they still doing it? Are they still doing it? Yeah, they're still doing it. They're in number one. To get people to change that pattern, wow, it's a lot of work, but they've done it. And the weatherman, Sam Champion, just came out. That was kind of exciting and interesting.
That's true.
After decades of being an open secret, he finally, you know, announced a marriage plans that he has with his partner. So that's nice to see as well.
Well, now in daytime talk shows, Ellen DeGeneres is killing it. She's crushing it. And she had Liam Neeson on last week and she called him to invite him on. And I thought we can listen in here on the call.
Wait, was she on Good Morning America?
No.
She just, on her own talk show.
She was calling Liam Neeson to. And this is what I mean by, you know, if Liam Neeson is your father, really avoid places where he's pissed people off. Listen to the phone call.
Hello, Liam. It's Ellen.
I don't know who you are.
DeGeneres. Ellen DeGeneres. Yes, you know who I am. Stop playing.
I don't know what you want.
Oh, I'm calling to invite you to be on the show Monday. I want to see your handsome face. How about that?
If you're looking for ransom, I can tell you I don't have money.
No, not ransom. Handsome. And you have tons of money. Taken made like $150 million or something like that.
What I do have are a very particular set of skills. Skills I have acquired over a very long career.
You mean dancing skills? I can't wait to see those.
Skills that make me a nightmare for people like you.
Scary. Hey, do you remember how to get here?
I will look for you. I will find you.
You don't have to look that hard. We're on the Warner Brothers lot. It's in Burbank.
And I will kill you.
Of course you'll kill me. You always kill when you're here. You kill it every time. Okay, I'll see you later, Liam. Bye-bye. Oh, boy. Nut.
Do you watch Ellen?
No. I just saw this clip and I thought, how funny is that that she was able to kind of cut that together in such a way to make it look like she was really talking to him.
I'm sorry she never got to play God. She was going to play, she could play John Denver. I think she was playing God in the remake of Oh God. It's a shame that never came to fruition.
Yeah, well, I just thought that was a nice little way to say, hey, there is somebody who's far more funnier than me, Ellen DeGeneres. Well, that brings us to our final story here in Big Deal or Big Whoop. Rapper Lil Wayne has had dozens of singles on Billboard's Hot 100, but he's also appeared on dozens of other people's singles as a guest rapper. See, that's what they do in the hip-hop world, actually.
As you would know.
They do that in every form of music. You know, that's just how Lil Wayne surpassed Elvis Presley for the artist with the most appearances on the Hot 100. Wayne has 109 appearances compared to Elvis's 108. Setting a new all-time record. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Big asterisk, I would say, if I'm saying that word
right.
Wait
a second. Is that because Lil Wayne did it when he was using steroids or?
No, nothing like that. No steroids.
Performance enhancing drugs? No.
And I don't think there are any peds involved.
Okay.
But like you say, he appeared on 42 hits as the main artist.
That's
so he has
artist.
Another 67 hits as a guest artist, or so, you know, there are tracks with three or four or five people on it in the rap world. So this is, you know, it's not as impressive as Elvis, but it is true. The other thing is that Elvis was a huge hit in 1956, but the Billboard charts didn't start until the current Billboard chart that we're talking about, the Hot 100, was launched in 1958. If you count his hits from the previous 2 years on the prior Billboard chart, the one that everybody followed, then he has more than 160 hits. So he's still ahead of Lil Wayne and all of his songs. Of course, he was the lead, but that it doesn't even end there. The cast of Glee has more than 200 chart appearances, though they're obviously not individual acts. But go back to like the Billboard charts, the definitive charts of their day. Bing Crosby, who is the original gangsta, he had 360 charting singles as the main act or the main duet with the Andrews Sisters primarily. But he has 360 songs that have charted on the Billboard charts on the whatever singles chart was dominant in that era. So that's three times as much as Lil Wayne. And on the vast majority of them, he was the man. He wasn't one of five or eight people. It was Bing and Bing and Louis Armstrong or Bing and the Andrews Sisters. You know, it was all Bing. So it's a good accomplishment for Lil Wayne. It reflects the world we're in now, where there's a lot of artists making guest appearances on other charts, but it doesn't come close to some of the standards that have been set in the past.
And I'm looking here on IMDb. I don't see where Bing Crosby starred in a gangster movie.
I bet he did.
Yeah, but that does not work nearly as well.
Off the top of my head, but I'm sure he's been at least beaten up by gangsters.
Yeah, but you see, that doesn't work at all for my joke.
Okay.
You know, while you're thinking about whether you should laugh, we should probably move on to Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And this week, Michael, of course, this story really does affect our listeners. We told you last year about a company hoping to launch a monthly movie pass that would let filmgoers see as many movies a month as they wanted for about, I think it was at the time, $50. After movie theaters and presumably distributors balked at the idea, MoviePass regrouped and a year later is now back with a retooled offering that frankly doesn't need the permission of either the cinemas or the studios. Here to tell us more about the new service is Stacy Spikes, the CEO of MoviePass. Mr. Spikes, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Perlin. Thanks, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Now, let me ask you this. What inspired the idea for MoviePass and how long have you been developing it?
We've been working on it for a few years now, and the general idea is so many things we do today are subscription models, your cable bill, your phone bill, going to the gym. You know, people today like to just pay a price that they know and just forget it, and it turns it into a utility, and we really believe that the theatrical window is ripe for it.
Well, that sounds like an interesting idea. Why have theater chains and studios sort of balked? Are they just scared of something new and different?
You know, I can't speak for them, but I know that any type of innovation, people move to it slowly rather than just jumping up and down. Everyone's in the establishment a bit cautious. Rightfully so. I mean, there's times things don't work and you don't want to bet the farm on it. So I think what we saw in the earlier iteration was just pause and hesitation. And so we heard what the chains and studios had to say. We sat down with them. We took everything from the customer to the studio to the chains, and we put it all of their things on a whiteboard and figure, how do we solve this problem for everybody? You know, what we ended up coming up with is this reloadable card, which we have now. It works on the exact same system that it currently exists, which is the credit card rails. And what we did was we added a layer of technology that allows the consumer to use their smartphone to check into theaters. And it, when they do that, it unlocks their card for them. So that's what was different, but it made it easier for everyone. It made it more seamless. It made it that we didn't have to plug into APIs of each different theater, which were just a headache and cost a lot more money.
And so how much does it cost to join MoviePass as a paid subscriber per month?
The national average is $29.99 a month. So it'll vary in your market based on the average ticket price in your market, but that's the average.
Okay, so I guess if it's you know, if you live in a place where the average ticket price is between $8 and $10, it'll be the $19.99. And if you live in a place like Los Angeles or New York, where the average ticket price is, let's say, $13 or $15, then the monthly cost would be what, $34.99.
Right. You're looking at a range of, I'd say the lowest can be $19.99 in certain select markets, and the highest you'll get is $39.99.
Okay.
So where are you at right now? You're accepting people who want to be a part of it, sort of a beta testing, I think, of the model is where you're at now. I looked at the website. I signed up to see if I could be eligible yet. And so I'm waiting for an invite. So what cities are you rolling this out in, or where is it happening?
Nationwide. So what you do is exactly what you described, Michael. You go on, you put your email at our website, which is moviepass.com. And we're trying to get through those invites as fast as possible. We were having as many as 35 people a minute submit their emails into that. So we're getting through the flow. We should have invites out to everybody in the next week or so. And we're very excited. People are signing up for their movie pass, and they just can't wait to use it.
So there's no city where you won't do business? You'll sign up anybody anywhere in the country?
As long as the theaters in that area accept major credit cards, no, anywhere in America. When you get the invite, is you'll go to a page and you'll put in your zip code and you'll see the theaters. All we did was, as long as they accept major credit cards, we put those theaters in the system, and that's all you need.
Well, there's no theater that doesn't accept major credit cards, is there?
There are some, believe it or not. There's some cash theaters. We have a few here in Manhattan. We were surprised at that. But there are some art house and some standalone.
What theater is a cash theater in Manhattan?
Yeah, there's about four of them. And there are a couple of more sizable theaters.
What are they?
Lincoln Plaza is one that we were surprised. It's just next door to Lincoln Center.
Yes, that you can do it over the phone, but you can't do it at the theater. That's true.
Exactly. You have to, if you do a walk up, you have to pay cash only. So there are systems that are set up where the online purchasing component is you can use a card, but if you're at the theater, they want you to pay cash only. So we were surprised we found more than what we thought were like that.
Well, let's talk about the online purchasing component for a second. So do you have to be at the theater? Because effectively, you go to the movie theater within 100 yards of the movie theater. You check in on your iPhone and eventually an Android phone and other smartphones. You check in. That unlocks this MoviePass credit card, this debit card that MoviePass has set up, so that you can go and buy a ticket with, instead of your regular credit card, the MoviePass card. And I mean, I guess my question is, how do you use the online purchasing component? Or is that not possible?
You don't. This is one of the things that we needed to manage is the people who control the online there's two ticket vendors who basically control that. And there's a fee attached to that. So naturally, us paying that fee on top of that was not something that becomes attractive for users over time. We didn't want to pass that fee on. So our service acts as a walk-up. Now, the wonderful thing is 96% of ticket sales in America are still walk-ups. So most people, except for it's twilight and you want to see it Friday night at 8 o'clock on opening weekend, most people tend to make their decision standing at the theater. So we wanted to tap into existing behavior and do it exactly how people are currently doing it. So you check in with the theater, just like you mentioned, and at that moment, it unlocks your card, and it gives you 30 minutes to be able to make a transaction, and then the card locks back up, and you can use it in 24 hours.
Well, it's funny, because just last week, Michael and I were arguing, talking about the fact that a recent study said that, you know, as you mentioned, 96% of all ticket sales are done over the, you know, basically as walk-ups. I guess the online ticket brokers you speak of here in North America are Fandango and MoviePhone, and I suppose they didn't want to be any part of this.
You know, we had early conversations, and one of the things is when you buy a $10 ticket and you pay $1.50 tax on that, you know, you're paying 15 to 20%. We didn't want to pay a 20% tax on top of what we're
paying.
There goes
your margin.
Right. If there was a way to do business where we weren't paying that, and that's the business that they're in. So there really wasn't a fit for us. So it was kind of mutual that if 96% of people walk up anyway and we don't have to pay a tax, great. It would then cause more of a headache and start to affect our business model in ways that, you know, that were problematic. And so most consumers are very happy with the service. It doesn't mean somewhere down the line there may not be some version of that, that the customer may, you know, say, I want to pay that tax, but we then say, if you want to pay it, you pay it.
It seemed like it was also a practical decision, because if you don't have to go to the theater and be right there to get your ticket, you could, of course, get a ticket a day every day from the comfort of your home and either sell them online and make back your money or give them away to friends.
Exactly.
Suddenly.
Exactly. That's exactly right. The other feature was a security feature where your phone and your card are locked together. Your phone and your card have to go to that theater. So even if you want to let a friend or do something, it doesn't work. You'd have to give your friend your phone and your card, and they'd have to go to that theater in order for it to work. And what we found was, when we polled people, we said, how likely are you to share a membership card? And people are like, oh yeah, I would share my membership card. But when we asked them, how likely are you to give your friend your phone for 4 or 5 hours? The answer was zero. No one would give their phone. There's a sense of security that comes with your phone. You don't want anything to happen to it. It's the way you communicate with the outside world. And people don't share their phones. They don't give their phones away to people.
Not to be devious, but couldn't I give my friend my password and they download the app as well?
It won't work. It locks into the UDID of your phone. So
okay,
it has your unique signature. When you create your account, it's locked into that. If your phone is lost or stolen, you have to call us up. We cancel the UDID in one, and we then transfer it to another. So it doesn't allow you, like a web browser, to just share your password and someone else logs in.
Some of the other limitations, I think, that are involved. I mean, I go to a lot of movies. I kind of always have liked the idea of a movie pass. I know some people who've received passes from a particular chain, like AMC or Lowe's. And so they've gotten this pass for a year. And I'm like, oh my God, it's like a golden ticket. You can go see as many movies as you want. It's so exciting. And so I've thought about a movie pass for a long time. It's intriguing. I take it no premium tickets are involved. You can't go see a 3D film. You can't go see an IMAX film. You can't go see any premium priced movie, I would assume.
The current level is 2D, and we are already working on a 3D and IMAX version. Clearly, that is going to be a more expensive proposition. We don't know what that pricing will be yet. We have the capability of turning that on, but we wanted to first get our basic package done. We're also looking at a less expensive package than the 2D, which would be 2D non-weekend. So if you're a person who loves going to movies, but you want to pay even less, we're looking at a Monday through Thursday version as well. So we're trying to address certain issues with the industry. The plane is flying empty. You know, I think 93% of inventory goes unused when it comes to ticketing.
Actually, I believe the industry average is about 85% of the time.
85?
Yeah, okay. 85%.
So 85% of that inventory is unused. And largely you're looking at the Monday through Thursday. So we're trying to address ways to drive more traffic to the theater during the week. Then you have your 2D 7 days a week, and then there'll be some form of a 2D, 3D IMAX, you know, deluxe version. Maybe bring a friend on it or something like that. And we're getting there, but we don't quite have all that buttoned up just yet.
Can you suspend it for a month? Because I go away on vacation, or I go to Europe for a month, and maybe I wouldn't want to pay my price that month because I know I'm not going to be going to the movies. I'm going to be out of town. I'm not going to be somewhere where I can go. So is it possible to put on hold for a month, maybe, and skip a month?
There are you can call up. And the two reasons we have, very similar to gym memberships, is there's a medical condition or there you are away. And so we do have that capability. You just have to call customer service and they'll manually do it.
So Sperling, take that reference to a gym membership and run with it.
Okay. Well, yeah. I mean, I wrote a story on Celluloid Junkie that said, look, you know, this is behavioral economics that, and you mentioned it yourself, that people are living off of subscription models, whether it be for the phone or a gym membership. And like a gym membership, I know that I belong to a gym. I just don't go there very often, or according to the last time I paid my membership ever. And I guess a lot of people do kind of set it and forget it. They pay for the gym membership. They feel good that they're, you know, they've paid for that gym membership, but then they start off going, you know, four times a week, and then they eventually go two times a week, and then eventually they don't go at all. Is that part of the business model? I mean, I would imagine that it very well might be.
Definitely in all subscription models, there's a usage versus cost variable, and they all work the same way. So if everybody overuses, you have a problem. We have certain people, like in a gym membership, who are going to go every day. They're going to work out at the gym every day. They're going to have these sculpted bodies that we all hate in the summertime. And, you know, like, look at that guy, you know. But there's also people who underuse and they don't use it as much. And then in the middle, you have seasonality. So you may go a lot during Christmas and then dip, and then you may go a lot during summer. So there's different type of users that are in the system. And so overall, there is a behavioral economics to it, as you mentioned, that balances everything out, makes for a profitable business.
That makes sense. People on the average go to movies about five times a year, four or five movies a year is the average moviegoer in North America. So your idea, of course, is that they're going to like the appeal of a pass. Even though they don't go that often now, they think, gee, I would go to more movies if I had a free monthly pass.
Yeah, we see that the usage, obviously, we're catering to the more than five times a year person. So our users start out probably at 1.2 times a month that they go, and they will hover around 2 to 3 times a month. So break even or slightly under. But again, you have people who behave over that. But what we found is the subscription service is a relationship with the customer, and customers who go more tend to also buy more DVDs. They tend to also purchase more graphic novels and other things related to movies. So there's several businesses here. There's what we'll call the Netflix component. Then you kind of have the iTunes or Amazon component, where there's a DVD or a soundtrack or music related to or something of that nature. And that business is a $20 billion a year business. Then you have the data side, where the ability to see aggregate information. So when are people going? What are they seeing? Which types of groups are going, which studio advertising is effectively working on some groups. So the data is very powerful. It allows you to see deeper into behavior than you normally would see with our current systems, which is largely a cash and carry business. So you have that intelligence. And then you also have an advertising perspective, where given your interest, we're able to put things in front of you that are like interest. So if you've seen every single James Bond, well, the new James Bond that's coming, you know, MGM can more accurately target you and give you things that will interest you to come out and support James Bond, because of they know that you've seen the last 2, 3, or 4 films. So, you know, they know that you've seen Daniel Craig's movies, even if he wasn't playing James Bond. That's the power of MoviePass.
So effectively, I mean, I'm not saying that if everybody overused the service, you'd still make money. But even if a few people do, or more than you're expecting, you can still make money in other ways.
Absolutely. So we see this as a 4 revenue stream business, not as a 1 revenue stream business.
which I think is actually quite interesting. What do the movie studios say, or do they not care? They basically say, hey, give us our $10 and we don't care how you pay for it.
I mean, we've met with them. We've had conversations with them. What excites them is we're paying full price for the tickets. And if we help to sell a DVD or a soundtrack, they're getting full price for that. So it's win-win across the board. The consumer's happy because they have kind of a one-stop shop where they're able to get the things they want and smart things are put in front of them. You know, the studios and chains are making full price and we're helping to drive traffic to theaters. So we think that this is one of those businesses that can level out the seasonality that is currently kind of part of the business. You start to level that out. And when you think about it, you know, there was once upon a time where cable didn't exist, right? And now a subscription service at home video didn't exist. So those players have kind of leveled out those playing fields and ultimately been beneficial to the industries rather than harmful to them.
So are you sending people emails or how are you reaching out to me? If I get a monthly pass, how are you telling me, hey, why don't you buy the DVD or the Blu-rays now available for Skyfall, the new James Bond film?
Yeah, it'll all happen right in the app.
Okay, because I was expecting a carrier pigeon. All right.
No. Shh, don't tell our secrets.
You see, Michael, somebody does like my jokes. Well, Stacey, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and to explain what MoviePass is all about. Certainly, I look forward to seeing how the business develops and to becoming a member myself and trying it out.
That's great. And I do want to add one exciting part that we have coming for the fall, which is the ability to gift MoviePass. So we will have gifting coming. You'll be able to give the gift of movies for, say, 30 days, 90 days, or even a year. So that people loved that last year. They were able to just give that to their family and friends and those movie lovers and their circles. And so we're excited to be able to bring that back and offer it with this new service that we have.
Now, out of curiosity, is there any thought given to maybe adding popcorn and concessions to the MoviePass card so that you can track whether the people who are using your card to pay for a movie ticket are also going into the theater and then buying, you know, $10, $15 worth of candy? Because I would imagine that the people who have already prepaid for their movie tickets without paying, you know, cash or a credit card, without laying that out right at the box office, they might be more inclined to buy concessions.
You are right. We saw 123% rise in the purchase of concessions among our users. We saw a 64% rise in their attendance, and they look at it almost as going to the movies for free. So they were 99% likely to purchase concessions, which is one of the things that really excited the theater chains when we gave them that news about the data on how our users, it was altering their behavior.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to join us and tell us all about it.
Sperling, Michael, thank you as well.
That's Stacey Spikes, the CEO of MoviePass, and you can go and sign up for MoviePass at moviepass.com. Thank you very much, Stacey.
Thank you.
Well, that was interesting. It'll be interesting to see how it works. I'm sure the studios would love to get their hands on the information that he gets if he gets 100,000 or 200,000 people signed up, data mining that info about their movie-going habits, you know, linking up, obviously not their individual names, but their age, their gender, and all that would be very interesting to the studios. It would be valuable material.
Well, yeah, I mean, it will actually begin to, at least for a specific demographic, these avid moviegoers, it will provide some data, that's for sure.
I'm intrigued by the going during the weekday. I mean, my mother goes to movies a lot, and she goes on the weekends, but she also, in the past, has gone during the week. You know, she's 80. Yeah, she's an older person. She listens to the show. I shouldn't have said her age.
She's 21. Again.
She's 21. she's a mature woman. And, you know, I could see when she went with her friends that they might have been intrigued if they got a pass that they could go Monday through Thursday or even Monday through Friday daytime. I don't know why you wouldn't include Friday, but like a $15 pass a month that you could go Monday through Thursday, you know, that might be very appealing to some people. I don't think I would buy it regularly, You know, I don't think I think I get too many screenings and all that stuff. But also, I think the limitations on when you go and what how you see a movie. Like if I'm going to go see The Hobbit, I'm going to be like, great. Now I don't can't use my movie pass, so I'd feel cheated every time I went to a 3D or a special screening or a premium priced IMAX, all that sort of stuff. I would feel a little annoyed because I think, see, I don't get to use my movie pass. That would drive me nuts every time.
Well, hopefully they'll work those issues out and you'll be able to use it even to buy clothing and Starbucks and everything else.
That's right.
But that brings us to our listener email. To those of you who wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com, that's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Of course, you can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And this week we have an email from Rebecca M. in Washington, D.C. Michael, do you want to read it?
It says, hey, kids, that's what we're supposed to call you, right? Yes, that's true. That's what you're supposed to call us. On last week's episode, number 165, you mentioned that vinyl sales were a paltry 3.9 million last year. Maybe you spoke too soon. This year's SoundScan is reporting sales of vinyl are up over 16% and are headed for, hold your breath, 4.7 million in unit sales. Here's a link to the story. Thanks for keeping us all up to date on showbiz news every week. Rebecca from Washington, D.C. I assume that's not the same Rebecca from the Broadway musical that just went up in flames.
No, no, I'm sure. Well, if it did, maybe she's paying, you know, maybe she can pay for the Broadway musical with all of those vinyl record sales.
That's right. So obviously she's right. You know, it's gone up 16%. It's still growing. It's now slightly over 1% of all music sales.
Right. And I think she's kidding around here. I think it was one of those ironic moments where we mentioned a figure, and that very week, Nielsen is releasing a more up-to-date figure.
Absolutely.
But as I mentioned, you can email us to dirt@showbizsandbox.com or call us 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to the show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher, or guess what? Your favorite podcatcher, an RSS reader. You can subscribe to an email that we send out when we post iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or on Stitcher, or guess what? Your favorite podcatcher, an RSS reader. You can subscribe to an email that we send out when we post a new episode. We send out one email per week and let you know when a new episode is posted. Links to all the stories we've posted on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to contact us or ways to subscribe. You can even find ways to follow us, although not necessarily physically, just virtually in the online world.
I wouldn't mind buying a Michael Pass. Surely somebody would do that, a one monthly fee to follow me around.
Or they could just follow you on Twitter. You can do that by following us on Showbiz Sandbox. That's our username, Showbiz Sandbox on Twitter. And we even have a Facebook page, and you can like us there. And guess what? The username there is Showbiz Sandbox. That's where you can find our page on Facebook. Again, our website is showbizsandbox.com for those of you who weren't paying attention to the first 50 times I mentioned it. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and really, he'd love for you to go there and never leave. Michael, what is that website?
MichaelGiltz.com, and that's where you can buy your monthly Michael Pass.
Oh, okay, I'm just going to make a note of that. You can find some of my writing on CelluloidJunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.